Well, I hate to jinx it, but it really feels like spring is finally here. And today on Garden Talk, we're going to look at how and when to add berries to your garden. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for joining us on The Larry Mueller Show. Vijay Pandian is back with us today. He is horticulture agent and educator for the UW Extension in Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. And we're going to talk to him about how to grow berries. And of course, we'd like to hear from you. What gardening questions do you have for him, berries or other? Join in by giving us a call, 800-642-1234. Or of course, you can always send an email, and that's talk at WPR.org. I'll never get used to that. Hey, Vijay, how you doing?
I'm good, Jill. How about yourself?
Well, I'm loving this weather. I don't know about the rest of the state, but down here in the Madison area, it is warm, sunny, and going to hit 70s. So,
same here, too, in southeast part of Wisconsin. It's going to be in mid-70s, actually, and so I'm looking forward to this nice weather.
I am, too. I have a feeling people are listening to us outside today.
Busy in pruning.
Yeah, exactly. Cleaning up that garden. I know I have plans for the weekend to do that for sure. So, you know, we're talking about it being nice in the air, but we really have to be concerned about the ground temperature, don't we, before we put anything out?
Absolutely. So the soil temperature matters a lot in terms of planting stuff. So when you think about planting any small fruit crops, you want to make sure your soil temperature is still about like 40 degrees, 45 degrees. So we just got to the soil temperature about 40 to 45 in southeast part of Wisconsin. So if you're not sure, you know, people living in northern part of Wisconsin, if you're not sure what your soil temperature is, it's very simple to do. Take a meat cooking thermometer, just stick it into your ground, wait for like 30 seconds, you know, and then see what your soil temperature is. If you have a consequently for like a 3 or 4 days of in a 40 to 45 degree soil temperature, then that is a kind of a minimum soil temperature requirement for planting any bare root crops. So you can do those things, yes.
Okay, that's good to know. I think that's because we do get a little anxious, don't we? And I know that the stores out there are going to have plants in them, and it's so tempting to go buy them and put them out. But that's really not a good idea, is it?
I mean, you know, it all depends, you know. I mean, if they're offering any reasonable price, yes, you can go and get it. But you can temporarily store them, you know, if you have an unheated garage or in your cold basement, you know, you can put them right in there. Many times, you know, when you do shop online, many of those online plants you get in more of a bare root one. So when you get those packages, open those packages, check the root system, if it is moist or dry. If it's moist, sprinkle a little bit more water around to it and wrap it back and put it back in your cold basement. And then wait till, you know, when you have ideal conditions outside, like nice and sunny out there, and your soil temperature is at least about 40 to 45 degrees, and then you can start planting them. Mm-hmm. But in case, you know, yeah, you know, like, you know, our spring seems to be fluctuating. You know, one day we get 70s, the next day we go back to snowstorm.
Yes.
If that's the case, you know, just be patient in this kind of situation. Temporarily store them in your cold basement or in an unheated garage, you know, wrap them in a wet towel paper, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Excellent. Good advice. Well, I'd like to start out by talking about strawberries first. They're pretty easy to add to a garden, aren't they?
Absolutely. One of the most easiest crop, I would say, to grow is strawberry. I mean, in strawberries, you know, you have a lot of different, you know, options right up here. So in Wisconsin, typically we do have summer-bearing strawberries, or we call June-bearing strawberries. These are the strawberries that start producing probably like, you know, mid-June, and it continues till about early, you know, in the month of July. Now, there is another kind of strawberry we call ever-bearing strawberry. And these ever-bearing type of strawberries, you know, right, even from the first year onwards, okay, they start producing some few fruits and continues till we have the first frost. Now, June-bearing strawberry that I told you just a few seconds ago, you know, they start producing only in the second year onwards. And you can grow them, you know, for 3 to 6 years, okay, in the ground. But the ever-bearing one, Pretty much you need to replant them every other year, you know, and if not, they lose its vigor and vitality. Then there is a third kind of strawberry, which is called day-neutral one. People, you know, sometimes prefer day-neutral one. These type of strawberries, right beginning like in July, mid-July, they start producing in a huge numbers. Okay, they have extensive daughter plants. They produce in a huge number. However, these day-neutral ones needs to be planted, you know, every year. They're not hardy for Wisconsin. So these are the three different kinds of strawberries. And again, you know, many people, if they don't have much space to grow these strawberries, try the day-neutral one. People grow those day-neutral ones in containers or in grow bags. Okay, make sure you water them up in during hot, dry summertime. You can get a bountiful crop from the day-neutral types. Now, if you do have some small space garden, then probably you can either go with the ever-bearing types or with the June-bearing types, you know. So, again, there are a lot of options here. Strawberry plants are one of the easiest plants to grow. All you need to do is to, you know, have a very loose soil, put some compost to it, and make sure that the crown of the plant is not buried too deep into the ground or too high above the ground. That is the only thing that you need to pay attention to it, so that the crown should be just sitting on the soil surface, okay?
Okay. Well, that sounds pretty easy, so hopefully we'll have some people experimenting this year. I didn't realize that there were three different kinds, so thanks for telling us that. That's great.
No problem.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones. We've got Taryn in Toma with a question. Go ahead, Taryn.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question. So I'm a new-timer house owner. I get to play with my own garden and everything, so I'm so excited. So it's my very first time, like, growing vegetables in my garden. I just built a raised bed this year. It's 8 foot by 4 foot by 1 foot. And I'm just wondering, just like any general yes and no-nos for growing vegetables in raised beds.
Okay. Well, thank you, Taryn. That's so exciting. I feel her excitement, don't you, VJ?
Definitely. And that really sounds wonderful, actually. And congratulations for being a homeowner. So starting a vegetable garden in a raised bed is a fun thing, and you will definitely enjoy it. So a few things you need to remember. Make sure your raised bed garden receives full sun about like 6 to 8 hours, okay? That's the first thing. Second thing, keep the raised bed a little bit closer to your house, okay, especially, you know, for accessing water. So I don't know how big of a yard you have, okay? So if a yard is like, you know, 50 to 100 feet away, then probably, you know, dragging the hose and watering them is like, you know, too much pain, okay? See if it's more accessible. The third thing I would also recommend is that, you know, I don't know about your landscape situation. So if you're one of the homeowners having a yard right next to a driveway or right next to a roadside, you know, stay away from that. Again, the other one thing is that if you have any, like, a tall trees, you know, make sure your raised beds are away from those tall trees, okay? Because the roots of those trees will compete and sneak underneath those beds. So when you're constructing a raised bed, few things matter. So you got the right dimension by 8 feet by 4 feet. Your bed should be always 4 feet in wide, so you don't have to, you know, walk in the middle of the bed to harvest any of the crops. So because your arms stretch from one side to the other one about 2 feet, so it's great. The length can be as much as you want. Now, underneath those beds, put up actually a landscape fabric. One of the best one would be the geotextile type of fabric because it has one side, it has this polypropylene type of material. And the other, on the top surface, it has more of a fabric. This prevents actually any strong roots, especially if you have like a silver maple, Norway maple, or even black locusts. They're notorious, okay, to sneak underneath. So put those fabric underneath and then, you know, put the bed on top of it. Now, when you're constructing the raised beds, okay, there are a lot of options you have. You know, there's always a question about, can I use a treated lumber or untreated lumber? Well, you can use an untreated lumber, you know, like a cedar lumber lasts longer compared to an untreated Douglas fir or pine wood, you know. They may last only for 3 years. One thing you can do in this untreated lumber is that you can stain the outside of it. You can use an oil-based stain and you can, you know, stain outside of those exterior of those beds. that'll give a little bit longer protection. Now, if you're using a treated lumber, make sure that this treated lumber is in category 4, which is used for residential purpose for ground contact. And most of the treated lumbers are being pressure treated with, you know, copper azole. And, you know, those can be used. But if you're still not sure about, you know, the copper leaching, you know, into your soil, then you can also put up a plastic liner in the interior of the wood. And you can also, you know, put some soilless media or media composed of one part with topsoil, one part with compost into it. So there are a lot of advantages in growing raised bed gardening. Raised bed gardening is more popular these days. You know, you can have a head start in growing, starting your crops. Soil temperature, since the soil temperature warms up very quickly, so you can have a very head start in growing this vegetable garden.
What are some of the things that she should stay away from as far as the vegetables that she puts into her raised beds?
Well, first of all, if you do have a black walnut tree, stay away as much as you can.
Okay. Oh, hopefully she does it.
You will be surprised. I mean, like in southeast part of Wisconsin, we do, especially people in countryside, we do have quite a bit of black walnut trees. So stay away from that as much as possible. But if you don't have a choice, then probably this type of landscape fabric, a thick landscape fabric underneath those beds will come in contact. You can place them underneath the ground. The other thing, you know, when you tend to watering a raised bed garden, okay, don't water the leaves. Place your wand actually to the base of the plant or use a soaker hose, okay? A lot of time, because in a raised bed, you know, it's a high-density planting system, and the plants will already will be trapped with the humid conditions right up there, and it's a perfect conditions for fungal diseases. So on top of it, when you're going to water them by shoveling on the top of the plant, you're going to spread a lot of diseases. So avoid that. Just place them actually, you know, water them just on the base of the plant. The other important thing about is fertilization. Raised beds do need to be fertilized. So oftentimes people in a fertilize either too early or too late. So I would recommend fertilize them in a before you plant them, just a week before you're planting, sprinkle some fertilizer and water the fertilizer immediately. That's one of the most important things. Now, since raised beds tends to dry out very quickly, just mulch them as well, too. You can use any, like a rice hull works very well, or you can use any clean straw. So these are some of the things you can take in consideration. Do you have any suggestions, Jill?
Well, I'm just wondering if things, you probably want to stay with a bed that small. You want to stay away from things like corn, right? Because you need a bit more for fertilization, is that right? Or pollination, rather?
No, I mean, it's not about that. So the depth of the bed matters a lot. So for example, you know, if you're starting to grow, you know, in an 8x4, like your bed is only about like an 8-inch high, you may not be able to grow successfully like potatoes, sweet potatoes, or even corn stalks right up there, okay, because they do need a little bit of a deeper bed, okay? So in those cases, your bed height should be about like 12 inches high.
Yeah, I think she did say that it was a foot high, so I think she's in pretty good shape, yeah.
Okay. So keep that in mind. Say when you're going to go with a tuber crops, you know, then probably at least a foot high. Now, you're right, actually. Sometimes like sweet corns, they could get about like, you know, as 6 to 8 feet tall, actually. And so some of those corns needs to be staked, actually, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point.
Because if not by the wind, it can actually, you know, snap very easily. Mm-hmm. So that's another biggest thing that you need to be taking into consideration.
Yeah.
You know what, Jill? One of the most important things many people complain about in raised beds, especially in the urban area, is about rodents.
Yes.
You know, because in a small space garden, you know, and especially in a raised bed setting, you know, sometimes you may have to fence it, especially to keep away the bunnies or even some of those chipmunks. And so probably there are a lot of ways you can do, but it's going to take a little bit of a laborious thing. Sometimes you may have to put up a cage on top of it using a chicken wire to keep those ground squirrels from sneaking underneath those things and disturbing your soil. But if it's simply a bunny, probably the best option is to fence around those raised beds. So those are the things I would take into consideration.
That is a really good point, because those rabbits are very good at stealing and eating things. So be aware of the rabbits in your area. Our guest today is Vijay Pandian. He is a horticulture extension educator for Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. What gardening questions are on your mind? Give us a call. The number, 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Najow. Next week on the show, we're going to talk to Laura Jull about pruning trees and shrubs. Hope you can join us again. Right now, we're talking to Vijay Pandian, talking about berries, but we'll also take some of your other calls. Now, Vijay, we talked about strawberries. Well, Krista in Appleton emailed to say that she would be interested in hearing more about your experience growing blueberries in raised beds, of which you're pretty much an expert. She said that they have clay in their soil and with what they suspect is the wrong pH for blueberries. So she wants to know, are there any alternatives to peat moss, since that material is less sustainable? She said, well, Larry had someone on who talked about woolets, which is little pellets made from sheep's wool. Would that be something she could use? And finally, would there be any downsides to using certain woods as the sides of a raised bed? And I think you did talk about that a little earlier as far as the wood, but what about growing blueberries in raised beds?
Well, for people who don't have naturally acidic soil, you can grow those blueberries in a soilless media. And your soilless media, typically that actually buffers and maintains the soil pH in more acidic forms are, peat, pine bark, or pine needles. These are the ingredients that you can use. Don't use any other ingredients like compost or like oak leaves or, those kind of things. So you mix these ingredients like 1:1 ratio, and either you can incorporate them in a large size container, or you can dig a pit like simply about like a 10 inch to 12 inch deep and probably 4 feet wide and length as much as you want. And then, put up a landscape fabric underneath and you can fill it back. Same thing with the raised beds too. When it comes to raised beds for blueberries, the bigger and the wider the bed, the more, sustainable in terms of their growth would be. If you have a narrow bed, probably, the roots may get frozen and we get stressed out very quickly. So we used 8 foot by 8 foot type bed, a large size bed, and about a height about like a 10 inches high, I would say, minimum. And then fill it back actually with this soilless media. Before you fill it back, put up a landscape fabric as a liner inside to it. If you're concerned about any of those leaching off any of those copper materials, studies have shown they're safe, but still, if you're not sure about it, then you can use those kind of liners, either using a plastic liners or something like that. Underneath those bottom side of the bed, put up a landscape fabric underneath to prevent any roots or any perennial weeds sneaking underneath. Fill it back with the soilless media. Now, the question is like, okay, yes, peat is not sustainable. It is actually, extracted from the bogs, and it is like more of those, fossilized type of material. Is there an alternative? So we are still trying to conduct some experiments and study some of the alternatives to peat. We do know that in parts of China, they have used rice hull. And they also used in other parts of, countries like in coconut coir can be also used as well too as a substitute for peat. But trying to access to those rice hull and coconut coir in such a large quantities could be a little bit more pricey. Now, in terms of using those sheep I haven't done anything. I haven't conducted any experiments on that to confirm it. Okay, but maybe in about a couple of years, we are experimenting using some other alternative materials. I can come up with some concrete answers to all those things. But currently, we've been more successful using with peat right now.
Okay, great. Well, good luck, Krista. Hopefully that helps. And is there something online that people can check? I think you did something for the Learning Store, right, about blueberries?
Absolutely. So if you're curious to know what varieties work and how to grow them in containers, trench, we do have an extension publications and a fact sheet. So just Google up growing blueberries UW extension. You will come across that fact sheet right away on the very first line. So that will give you detailed information in terms of, what type of fertilizer to be used, how to prune them, after 4 or 5 years later. Those informations will be the detail in that fact sheet.
Okay, and there's so much there if people are interested. So just check it out. It's just fun to read it, too. So it's basically like Vijay said, you can Google that, or if you just go Learning Store, that also will bring it up. So let's go to Jane in Minocqua. She also has a question about blueberries. Go ahead, Jane.
Hi, good morning. Hi, Vijay. This is Jane. I might have missed some of the information that you just gave to the previous caller, but I also have blueberries. We just planted last year some heirlooms, and they're in the ground. The soil is rather sandy. We did add peat. So my question is, what's the best thing I can do to just kind of encourage growth and fertilizer, that type of thing, for this year?
Yeah, absolutely, Jane. So the very first thing is that if you haven't done any soil pH test before, I would suggest actually sending your soil sample to the UW-Madison Soil Test Lab. Just for pH test, it only costs $5. But that information will be very valuable. So you know exactly, how much amount of amendments you need to do, whether you really need to do it or not, those informations, will be revealed based on the soil pH test. So do send a sample. Second thing is that, generally, when you're amending your sandy soil with a peat, I would also incorporate once a year in the springtime using sulfur, elemental sulfur. You can get this elemental sulfur in many garden centers, and it is typically labeled for, turning your hydrangea plants into blue, those kind of type of products, So you can use that. Generally, about adding about 1 tablespoon around, sprinkle it around your plant and water it, or you time it based on when it's going to be raining. And that will really help actually in, minimizing your soil pH. And again, based on your soil pH test, you need to do it. So here in southern part of Wisconsin, especially in southeast part of Wisconsin, we are in alkaline zone. So we have to. But, in Minocqua, those northern part of Wisconsin, you may have naturally acidic soil. In those kind of conditions, you don't need to do it. Then probably in terms of fertilization, so you have options. So beginning like in mid-May to late May, you can use some sort of like a liquid fertilizer, like using Muracid, which is again, used for, fertilizing your azaleas and rhododendrons. And this Muracid, make sure that you dilute it in a gallon of water, read the instructions in the product label, and you drench it. Not a foliar application. I had some people did a foliar application and burnt the leaves. So make sure to drench it to the base of the plant. And you repeat it like once about a month or once in 3 to 4 weeks and till about like mid-July. So basically you might be fertilizing it only for like a 2 or 3 times at the very maximum. And after mid-July, you stop fertilizing. You don't want to trigger any new growth after mid-July. If not, they're not going to go for dormant mode. So fertilizing is the options that you have.
Okay, well, good luck, Jane. It's everybody really would love to have blueberries in their yard, but it's not that easy, so good luck to you. Let's go to Dave in Appleton. He's got a question for you. Go ahead, Dave.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I actually have two questions, if that'd be okay. My first question is, I'm thinking about making a makeshift greenhouse with cattle fencing from my house down to the ground, about 5 feet out and about 30 feet long, and covering it with plastic. Will, it's facing the south. Will that work for late fall and into the winter? Will that stay warm enough to grow plants in the ground since it is against the house? That's my first question.
Absolutely, yes. Definitely many small fruit crops would love it, especially if you're thinking about, like, you know, overbearing raspberries. You know, you may be able to harvest them a little bit earlier, you know, probably even like, you know, mid-July, you know, you'll start to see some of those early crop production happening up. So in these type of, you know, hoop house system, you know, has more advantages. At the same time, there are some disadvantages as well too. So the major advantage is that you're going to have a head start. And in terms of growing some many small fruit crops, you know, you're going to have an early harvest, and you may also extend the season as well too. And you may be able to grow a lot of, you know, other varieties, which may be also marginally hardy. We can also grow them in this kind of hoop house system. Now, here's a downside, actually, is that, you know, sometimes in a hoop house system, it can get very hot, and it can go, temperature can go to 100 degrees easily. So make sure to roll those ends of those, you know, hoop house, or maybe have an, you know, internal ventilation fan to, you know, remove some of those hot gas, actually, that has been, you know, piling up inside those things. At the same time, hoop house also has more another advantage, especially in this type of weather conditions, fluctuating weather conditions, okay, hoop house can actually buffer from all those fluctuating weather temperatures, especially in the spring or in the fall system, fall weather conditions. So, yes, definitely you can use a hoop house system to grow your plants, and it can definitely warm up your soil and maintain the soil temperature relatively, you know, and will be quickly to warm up your soil using that, yes.
Okay, thank you so much, Dave. And we did talk to the straw bale gardener guy, Joel Karsten, and he's got some plans, I think, on his website on how to use the cattle fencing for a hoop house, obviously using the straw bales, but I think you could probably adapt it too. So if you're looking for some specifics, might not be a bad idea. If you've got a question for VJ, give us a call, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send an email, and the address for that is talk@wpr.org. And we do have an email from George to ask for advice on dealing with disfolia flies and grubs. Can you help him out, VJ?
What kind of fly is that?
He just changed it. Drosophila. Yes. Okay.
There is a, you know, invasive fly called spotted wing Drosophila, okay? And this is actually, you know, is one of the big issues in many small fruit crops, including raspberries, okay? And it usually emerges probably in the summertime, mid-summertime, when the raspberries are actually about to ripe. So the very first thing about the spotted wing Drosophila is that make sure you set up a trap so that you can able to monitor when they actually emerge, so you can do some precision spraying if needed. So that is one good thing to do. So the trapping, you know, you can use some simple as a yeast-based one, or like you can use some like a sugar molasses type of thing, and you can hang some of those things in your, you know, small fruit areas. Now, we do have an extension fact sheet that details about those information on how do you set up those traps. Then once you time it, when this spotted wing Drosophila gets attracted, you know, to those traps, you know, you need to make sure to check almost every day. And then you can hit it with some sort of like a, you know, non-residual type of, you know, insecticide. Like, you know, some of most of the organic insecticides, you know, can also be used as well too. So you can use those non-residual short period type of insecticides, and you can spray it. And these non-residual type of insecticides in a doesn't last that longer. So maybe after like 24 to 48 hours, you can still harvest those fruits. But if you are kind of a gardener, you don't want to use anything to spray anything like those things, probably you can also, you know, what you can do is that you can harvest them prematurely, and, you know, and you can try to ripen it in a inside your house if possible. Or probably you can, you know, try to freeze your fruit. That's also possible too. So there are some options available, but I would say, you know, use some sort of organic insecticides, you know, to control the spotted wing drosophila.
What about the grubs?
I was kind of wondering what type of grubs he's talking about. Are those the grubs, the maggots from the spotted wing drosophila he was talking about? Or he was referring to grubs from like Japanese beetles or some other type of grubs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he doesn't say.
Yeah, so I'm kind of, you know, having that, assuming that, you know, he might be referring to those spotted wing drosophila maggots, okay? These are the tiny maggots. So the female, what she does is that she has a serrated oviposition layer, you know, which is more like a sawtooth type. She actually makes those serrations on the fruit and lays the eggs inside to with the fruit. And the eggs hatches up and becomes like a tiny maggot. And these maggots actually chew the flesh out of it. So one thing to do, and when it gets to the stage when the female lays her eggs, is too late to do anything to it. In those cases, you know, when you feel that when you crush those fruit, you will see those maggots coming out of it. If that is the case, I would actually use those, you know, infected fruit, bag them up, and you destroy it, either by burning it or probably, you know, putting into, you know, a Ziploc bag, or you trash it. You know, some people, it doesn't matter. They freeze it and they eat it. That's fine, you know.
A little protein.
I've been... We don't have any record saying that is, you know, causing any human health concern. I haven't heard about that, but it's your risk that you're going to take. Yeah.
It's so disappointing when you see a beautiful raspberry sitting there and you pick it and there's that lovely little white worm looking at you. Yeah, very. All right, well, let's go to Carl in Eau Claire. Go ahead, Carl.
Yeah, hi. I recently had a soil test done on my garden in Eau Claire, a vegetable garden, and the results came back at a real high level of phosphorus. So my question is, what can I do to remediate that?
Okay. A lot of time in many cases in Wisconsin, we do have high phosphorus in the soil because any organic materials that decomposes, you know, releases phosphorus, okay? And plus, you know, we tend to have a lot of lawn, and in the past, we used to add a lot of, you know, phosphorus-based fertilizers in the past. So naturally, we have built up a lot of phosphorus in our soil. Now, whether this high phosphorus is going to, you know, affect my plant? Not really. Most of the phosphorus gets locked up into the soil, okay? So the available phosphorus for the plant is not that much, okay? So I would not worry about, like, you know, oh my God, I have too much phosphorus. What should I do about it? Is it going to hurt my plant? No, it's not. So one thing, if you're still concerned about it, you can actually dilute it with some more organic matter if possible, but it doesn't need to be more concerned about it. Now, the thing that I would be concerned about is that potassium and your organic matter. So in vegetable garden, I've been coming across some few soil test report cases where the potassium seems to be very low. the role of potassium in plant growth is very important. The potassium is the third one that says NPK, where the K stands for potassium. Potassium is like more like a jack of all trade in plant growth. What it means is that, you know, it regulates the water movements in the plant. It also regulates the stress level as well as in the plant too. So it has a multifunctional role. So sometimes lack of potassium causes your plant to looks like your plant has been scorched out by stress or moisture stress, okay? It kind of gives you that type of symptom. So, and also potassium plays a key role in defensive mechanism. So why do you think in the lawn, you use a winterizing fertilizer, which has a lot of potassium, because winterizing fertilizer, potassium has more of those winter hardiness for the lawn, provides that. So that's the reason why we have potassium in the fourth application. But needless to say, that would be the thing I would be concerned about, whether you have enough potassium in your soil. Then the third one would be the organic matter. So generally, you need to have about like 4 to 5% of organic matter in your vegetable garden. In lawns, people, when you see when your lawns in the summertime, it's like a more like a rock hard, like a clay. Those lawns would be more like a 2%. So you need to enrich your soil. That's why, you know, for a vegetable garden to grow very well, you need to aerate the soil with a lot of organic matter. So minimum, you need to have at least, 4 to 5% of organic matter. So, and then finally, the pH. So pH is the one that tells whether your soil is acid or alkaline. And that is also going to dictate whether your plant can able to absorb those nutrients that you're going to apply in the soil in the form of nitrogen or potassium, whatever it is. If your pH is either too alkaline or too acid, then the plant will stop absorbing any of those nutrients. And so even though you're dumping a lot of nutrients, they may not be able to absorb them because the pH is the one that dictates actually whether it can be absorbed in the plant. So generally, your pH should be close to neutral. So a neutral pH would be more about in the range of 7. So you can have a pH from 6 to, to about maximum 7.5, 7.6 in that range. Anything that goes about 8 is too high of a pH. So you can send a soil sample to your soil test lab. And, you know, like you said, you already did that. But check your soil pH range. Check your organic matter, check your potassium level. These are the things that I'd be concerned about. But if you do have high phosphorus, not to worry about that.
Okay, best investment you can make in your garden is to get that soil tested. All right. Well, we are talking with UW Horticulture Extension Educator Vijay Pandian today. What gardening questions do you have for him? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Oops, I'm sorry. There was just nothing. Yeah, thank you very much, Lee, for telling me I had to actually talk. This is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. Coming up on Garden Talk next hour, we're going to talk about getting your seed started. But right now, we're talking to Vijay Pandian, and we're talking about berries and other gardening questions. And speaking of berries, we've had a couple of emails about raspberries. So Kent emailed to say that he has a mixed variety of blackberries, but sometimes he sees only the start of berries that don't mature, and this is going on year after year. What should he be doing about that?
That's an excellent question, Jill. I had the same issue in my trial garden. So blackberries, okay, the domesticated one are the cultivated type blackberries, okay? Not that many are hardy for Wisconsin, so only there are a few ones. So just like raspberries, you know, the blackberries, you know, the one that has been recommended for other part of the United States, they tend to grow in produce of fruit crops in floricanes. Floricanes are the second year canes that produce the flowers of the fruit. And after it's done with the fruiting, they die back. And the primal canes are the vegetative canes. In the first year, they produce simply the leaf. They don't set the flower. And the second year, they tend to produce the flower. And then it becomes floricane. Now, there are certain varieties of blackberries, okay, that actually produce the flower even in the very first year cane. So in the early part, it becomes more of a primal cane producing the leaf. And then later in the summertime, the tip end of those canes, they produce the flowers and then set the fruit. So a couple of varieties like Prime Arc is one of the one. Then there is also, you know, your dwarf varieties like Baby Cakes, you know. So I was thrilled to have them, actually, to test it in my trial garden, you know, that finally we have some, you know, interesting new varieties for Hardy for Wisconsin. And when I tested it, it ended up in disappointment, just like the viewer has said. You know, it produced the flower in late in the summertime, early in the fall, and the, many of the times, those fruits were not mature enough, and it actually stopped producing, actually, you know. So it was a failure. So the reason probably is that we don't have enough longer growing season, actually, for these type of, you know, raspberry, the blackberries that produce on the primal canes. So I would say, you know, it is a typical for some of those, you know, blackberries. So don't try to attempt to grow them. Rather, here's what I would suggest, actually, is you don't actually prune those canes. You leave that cane like it is and let it grow for the next year. In the next year, that same cane will continue to produce probably in about like early summer. It starts to produce flower. By mid to late summer, you can harvest the fruits. So, which means that, you know, even though they produce the flower in the first year, you may not going to get the harvest from it, but let it grow. Don't prune it. Leave it like it is. Come back in early to midsummer. It'll produce the flowers and set the fruit. And after done with it, you cut it. So treat them more of actually like a, you know, a floricane type of, you know, system right up this.
Okay, great. Thank you. Bonnie in Wanakee, speaking of Baby Cakes raspberries, she has some in her raised bed and they haven't done well. She wants to transplant some of them to containers. Can they do that? Can they do that now or should they wait for a month or so? And what's the thought about putting raspberries in containers? So there's a couple of different things there.
Is it a raspberries or blackberries she was referring to?
She says Baby Cakes raspberries.
Yeah, so Baby Cakes are blackberries because a raspberry is that it's a shortcake.
Okay.
So raspberries, that is a variety called shortcakes raspberries, okay, which can be grown in a containers or raised beds or in a small space garden setting. So those are for raspberries. Baby Cakes are for blackberries. Now, the Baby Cake blackberries, okay, I've been growing in a raised beds, okay, and I have a mixed feeling about this one. You know, it doesn't set that much of fruit because of the, you know, we didn't have enough longer growing season. The interesting thing about the Baby Cakes are is that they are thornless, so, which is a big relief for many gardeners.
Yes.
And it's also compact and bushy. But in terms of a yield or the production-wise, it is not that great for Wisconsin because it needs a little bit more longer growing season for them to do. And it tends to get wider over the years. So now trying to grow them in a container is not a good idea for these type of Baby Cakes or blackberries. So probably it gets root bound very quickly. And besides in a getting root bound, you're going to see actually, you know, some lot of diebacks going to happen. You also have to prune them. So you're going to end up in having a more of a high maintenance actually with that one. But one thing you may want to experiment if you still insist on growing them, now is the time, scoop it up from the ground, put it in a larger size container, and try to experiment it probably, you know, in the fall time, maybe, you know, put up some sort of like, you know, maybe a small hoop house or maybe bring them back actually in a greenhouse settings or something like that and see if that, you know, it helps in producing the crops in a little bit longer in the fall. So that's something you can try. But again, you know, you are inviting yourself with too much work, I would say.
Okay, well, good luck with that. Now, when it comes to blackberries and raspberries, they can kind of grow wild, obviously, but they can kind of get out of control. What's the best way to kind of keep them in their beds and make it easier to get in there and get the fruit?
That's an excellent question, actually. And many gardeners, including myself, we do struggle in a small space setting because, you know, when you do have a small space garden, you know, these raspberries and blackberries, you know, they tend to produce all those suckers, and these canes are very notorious. They grow so vigorously. So in ideally, you know, you need to train them. So especially for raspberries, okay, that is a training system called like a trellis, T-shaped trellis system. Training system is available. But again, you know, if you're talking about one or two raspberries, these trellis system may not be very effective unless you have a row of them, then it makes sense, actually, you know. Mm-hmm. So we do have an extension publication that details in elaborately about this trellis system, how to establish them. So you just Google up growing raspberries, UW extension, you'll come across the publication that talks about it. Now, if you're one of those gardeners like me in my trial, but I have only one or two raspberries, probably in those system, probably doing a good pruning is the best thing to do. So raspberries, you have two different kind. One is the summer bearing and the fall bearing type, you know, red raspberries. Now, the fall bearing raspberries are the easiest way to prune and maintain them. So all you have to do in late in the fall time, or early in the spring before the bud breaks, cut all the canes down to the ground, close to the ground. You know, that's it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, so the new canes come in. But if you find there are too many canes suckering out, then probably you can take a sharp shovel and you can slice those suckers out of those things. Now, when you talk about summer-bearing raspberries, it's a different story. You have a two pruning system you need to introduce. One, in the summertime, after you're done with the harvesting, that flowery cane that produced the fruit and you harvested that cane, you need to cut them back. And then in the wintertime, late in the wintertime, select only about like a three to four sturdy canes, okay, per foot, and thin out the remaining canes off. So, and then you can also do some tip pruning, we call it the heading back. Just to stimulate a little bit more sturdiness of those canes. If not, they will droop. So you do a little bit of a tip pruning, but not more than 1/4 of the canes. So that also helps actually in maintaining the sturdiness of the summer-bearing raspberries.
Okay, well, that's excellent information. And we did get one more email from Lori. She said that their area has been hit really hard with iridescent beetles. I think we both know who those are. And they're destroying the raspberries, the beans, and many other flowers. Is there any way that she can safely treat her vegetables to get rid of the beetles? Japanese beetle, probably, Vijay?
Yes, say it is very likely it would be Japanese beetles, but in the Japanese beetles, you know, they are voracious type of beetles. They will have, they like bush beans a lot, you know, so if you do have, also they do like peas a lot, so if you do have those things, they will skeletonize those leaves. So if that is the case, so late in the evening, you know, what you can do, you can also literally harvest those Japanese beetles.
Yep.
Put it up in a soapy water, you know, you can drown it. That's one thing to do. Early in the morning, they're more sluggish. They're just actually still in the sleepy mode and they're trying to warm up. So you can also easily pick them up and, you know, you can do it. The other option is that, you know, there's always floating row covers available. Floating row cover is one of the great tools for gardeners. It's just like a polyester spun type of fabric material that allows the light and the air into it, but not any of those bugs and stuff. So you can drape them in the late in the evening time after the pollinators are all gone back to sleep. So you can put them actually to prevent those Japanese beetles coming and attacking it. Or if you do have any like a fine mesh materials, less than about a quarter inch, you know, you can also those use those fine mesh netting materials as well too, and you can stake them down to the ground. That's another option. Finally, you know, none of these options works actually, especially on your bush bean plants or something like that. Then you can think about using some organic insecticides like neem green, but use that as a last resort. But, you know, like I said, just do some manual picking or probably use some sort of floating row cover or netting materials.
All right. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for all your advice, Vijay. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to UW Horticulture Extension Educator Vijay Pandian. Stay with us because we have more coming up with Diana Allfuth talking about starting your seeds. After months of waiting, it's finally time to start your seeds. In this hour of Garden Talk, we're going to talk about how to make sure that you have healthy seedlings to add to your garden next month. I'm Jill Najoe, and this is the Larry Mueller Show. Back with us from the northern part of the state is Diana Allfuth. She recently retired as the UW Extension Horticulture Outreach Specialist for Pierce County. So whether you're new to starting your seeds inside or you've been doing it for years, we can help you with your questions and, of course, your other gardening questions too. So give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Hey there, Diana. How you doing?
Hey, Jill. I'm good. How are you?
I'm excellent. I'm loving this weather. Go ahead. You were going to say something?
It is an exciting time of year, isn't it?
It is.
Especially for gardeners who have been waiting so long, and now suddenly it's seed starting time.
last time we chatted, you were just about ready to start your seeds inside. How can you tell when it's time to do that?
Well, it depends on your experience level and what it is you're trying to start. So for beginners, I really recommend that you start things that don't require more than 8 weeks in advance. Start with some of the easier things, which shockingly, I say tomatoes are one of the easiest ones, and they're the most popular anyway. But otherwise, things like marigolds, you know, they only require, on the seed packets, it'll say start 6 to 8 weeks prior to planting outside. And that's a good way to start. There are other things that you can grow from seed, like geraniums and impatiens, but those are going to need like 12 weeks and stuff. And the longer that you're growing them inside, the more chance for failure. And so not that you can't grow them. And as you're experienced, you know, I definitely recommend you branch out and do those things. But if you're a beginner, start with something that would be 8 weeks in advance. And here in my area in West Central Wisconsin, people are always like, when should I start seeds? And I always say, don't be a fool and plant them before April Fool's Day. Because, you know, we don't know what the spring weather is going to be, right? And so we don't know exactly when will be the time to plant them out. But it's better if the seedlings are a little younger when they go out than too old.
And is that the reason? Is that they're just, what, getting too leggy or?
Well, they might be depending on how you grow them. So what I'd really like to start with is, so if I see out on social media and stuff, people who are beginners and they want to start seeds and they'll post something like, can I do this? And then there's a whole bunch of different responses that people say, I do it this way. I do this. I do that. I do that. And all of those things have merit, right? But what I really want beginners especially to understand is there is no one way to do it. You can do it in an infinite number of ways. And it doesn't have to be a big investment. You don't need to invest in, you know, seed starting trays and light systems and all that if you're starting with some of these basics like tomatoes and marigolds. So what I'd really like to start with is just talking about how seeds grow into little plants. And if people understand what seeds need to grow into nice, stocky, healthy seedlings, then how you provide those little seedlings with what they need is totally up to you.
Okay. Well, tell us.
All right. So, so we have to remember that inside the middle of every seed is a dormant little embryo. So you may have like popped open a peanut or a bean seed and it looks like there's a baby plant in there. There is. It's an embryo, and that's in the middle of every seed, but obviously you don't see it in a lettuce seed that's so tiny, right? But that is just waiting for all the conditions to be right to start growing. And the first thing that happens when we want to germinate our seeds is first thing that seed has to soak up water. And once the water gets in that seed, that starts activating enzymes and chemical reactions that go on in that seed and cause that embryo to start growing. And it'll start by sending out a root called a radical, but it'll be the first root, and then the top will emerge up above. So first and foremost, once you plant your seeds, you have to make sure they have moisture and that they stay moist, because if that growth process has started and then it's allowed to dry totally out, it kills it. Okay, so once you start, you got to keep it moist, not wet, but moist. And then in that seed, there's some stored energy in the form of starches. And that's what that little seedling, that little embryo is using to grow, because it needs energy. It needs calories, right? So it's using that stored energy in the seed to grow that root and grow that top that's going to pop up to the seed. The bigger the seed, the more stored energy there is. So if you think of a bean or a pea, they are pretty big. They have a lot of stored energy. So you can plant them a little deeper, whereas a tiny little seed like a radish or a lettuce seed doesn't have much. So that needs to be near the surface, because a plant's food, unlike the labels on the fertilizer bags, fertilizer is not plant food. Okay, fertilizer is plant vitamins, so it's like your one-a-day vitamin. The plant's food is the starches and sugars and carbohydrates that are formed during the photosynthesis process. So this little seedling wants to grow. It wants to get those first leaves out exposed to the light so that it can start doing photosynthesis and creating food to grow and continue the process. So what we want is to get our little seedlings up and collecting sunlight as fast as possible. And then in order to make strong seedlings, we have to make sure that the growing conditions are correct. And that usually means high light. And that's what's a challenge when we're growing seedlings indoors, because it's not as bright light as it is if that seed was to have sprouted outside. And even if you've got your seedlings on a south window and there's all this sunlight hitting them, that sun, the intensity of that sun is way less on the inside of that glazed and treated window than it is on the outside of that window. Plus, it's still March. Okay. And we're in Wisconsin. And so our days are getting longer, and we love that, but they're still on the short side, and the sun angle is still working its way up. So our sun isn't super, super strong. So what we really need to do is provide as much light as we can for these little seedlings. And that's why the shorter the period that they are growing inside with the like tomatoes and marigolds, why it's so much easier to be successful than something that requires 10 to 12 to 14 weeks ahead of time.
That was wonderful information. I don't think I've heard that since maybe seventh grade science class. So thank you for going over that, because there's really a lot of thought, you know what I mean, things to think about when you are growing. That information just makes it easier. So thank you for that. So we did get a couple of emails about growing seeds. So let me go to Jerry. He's asking for suggestions for preventing mold from developing on the soil surface while waiting for the seeds to sprout. So that goes back to moisture.
Right, right. So one of the things that we didn't talk about is the equipment that you use. When I was growing up, my mom used to grow her tomato seedlings in egg cartons.
I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah, just on the windowsill on the south window. And, you know, they weren't the highest quality seedlings by the time she put them in the garden. But you know what? We had more than enough canned tomatoes every year to get our family of six through the winter. So the plants can be forgiving, and they can catch up to things. So what you need to do is to just have your container doesn't need to be the purchased little cells with the plastic dome and all of that kind of thing. You can plant them in egg cartons. You just need like 2 inches deep and about 2-inch diameter root zone area. Because again, these little seedlings are only going to be growing in here for 8 weeks. I used to use those seed trays and stuff, but now over the winter, I just save a few. I'm great for recycling on this. Okay. So my husband was eating snack pack pudding for a month and these little plastic containers. And I thought, oh, just save those, you know? So you just poke a hole in the bottom of them for drainage and woof, you've got, you know, perfect little seed starter things. But I also use things like, you know, when you buy the lettuce in the store in the clamshell thing that's about 4 inches high, that's wonderful for starting seeds. You don't need to have individual cells. If you plant, when you space your seedlings, just space them several inches apart, they can all grow happily together in something like that. So you need a container that's about 2 inches deep, has drainage holes, and then you need a seed starter mix. And this is the one thing that I really recommend that you invest in. And it's not expensive, but that would just be a bag of seed starter mix. And there are lots of different brands out there. Try to find one that's, you know, kind of fine. My go-to that my mom always used to use is Jiffy Mix, but there's a lot of different brands out there. And it's mainly finely milled peat moss. So it's really fine, but it's sterile. And so it doesn't have any disease organisms in it. And that's getting to the question here about the mold on the surface. All of these seed starting mixes, they're organic matter. There's no sand, silt, or clay in there. They're compost or composted wood chips or that kind, or peat, that kind of thing. And there's going to be decay organisms in there because that's what nature does, right? It rots stuff away and breaks it down. So if you're getting mold on the surface, you're overwatering and you're watering too often. So what's really important is, A, we want to get those seeds sprouted as quickly as possible. You can get the warmer the soil where that seed is, the faster the chemical reactions will happen within that seed and the faster it will sprout. So you can get heat mats and use that. It's not really recommended that you use a human heating pad because they're not waterproof. So that's, you know, a little iffy there. But I have in-floor heat. And so I just set the trays on that and that warms the soils a little bit. And we want those seeds to pop up as fast as possible. When you see the seed starting kits in the store, they have this plastic dome over that, and they have on the picture, they have all these leafy plants growing under that plastic dome. That is the falsest advertising, because covering them with some kind of plastic, whether it's the plastic dome or a piece of plastic wrap, when you plant the seeds, you make sure the soil is moist. You mist them after you plant the seeds so that those seeds have the water to soak up, like I talked about. And then you put some kind of plastic on just to keep those seeds from drying out. But the second, and I mean the second, you see any kind of germination of those seeds, you want to take that plastic cover off, because that high humidity is not good for the seedlings. And that's where you get diseases. So if you're getting a little mold on the surface while you're waiting for the seeds to germinate, which is, I think, what the email said, then first off, I wouldn't really worry about it. You might have your soil mix a little too wet, but that mold is probably just living on that organic matter in that potting mix, and it's not really affecting the seed. But as soon as you see any signs of germination, off comes the top, and then you want that surface to dry out just barely in between waterings. You don't want it wet all the time, because the biggest problem with tiny little seedlings is a disease called damping off. And I think it's caused by Pythium, which is like a water mold, and it goes along the surface, and it basically like strangles the little seedling right at the soil surface, and your little seedlings like fall over, and it happens in the day, and it's heartbreaking. But if you don't let that soil surface dry out before you water, once those seedlings are up, you're really setting yourself up for damping off.
Okay. Thank you for that email, Jerry. Good luck with that. We're talking with Diana Alfith. She's recently retired as the UW Extension Horticulture Outreach Specialist for Pierce County. If you have a question for her, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Hope you can join us again next week on Garden Talk. We'll be looking at an Iowa program that helps grow pollinators for butterflies. And then we'll talk about pruning trees and shrubs with regular Laura Gel. Right now, we are talking to Diana Alfith, and we're specifically talking about starting your seeds. But we can, of course, take other questions, too. So if you have some, give us a call. Our phones, our lines are open, 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. So, Diana, before we went to the break, we were talking about water and the importance of too much, too little. How do you water your seedlings or your seeds after you plant them?
That's a great question. When you're starting your seeds, make sure that your seed mix already has moisture in it. So, like, I just started my seeds this last week, and I used seed starting mix that I had left over from last year, and it was so dry that if you pour water on it, it all just floats and it becomes hydrophobic. So it takes a lot to soak that up. I literally had to let it soak for 2 days until it got, I was shocked at how long it took this year to do that. So make sure that you moisten that seed mix before you fill your containers. And then you put your seeds on top, and then shake just a little bit of that potting mix over the top. And for something like tomatoes or peppers or marigolds, the rule of thumb is that you bury the seed twice the diameter of that seed. So we're talking about an eighth of an inch of soil that goes over these seeds, right? And I like to use a little colander that I just shake the seed mix over the top. And it's important to try to cover them uniformly so that they all germinate at the same time, because then, as I said, you're going to be taking that top off and stuff. So we want them to all sprout as much as close to the same time as possible. So after you sprinkle your seed starting mix over the top, use a misting, you know, a little mist bottle, and just mist it. If you pour water in, you're likely going to float the seeds and bury them and dislodge them and stuff. So mist the top and then put your plastic stuff over the top to keep that in. And then it'll be keeping it moist until those seeds germinate. Once the seeds germinate, you can do it two ways. If you have good drainage holes in your containers, you can bottom water. So you pour water in the tray and let it soak up from underneath, or you can gently water from the top. And then you want to make sure that you water thoroughly so that the water goes down and starts coming into the tray. And that way, you know that root ball has gotten all of the moisture that it needs. The key, as I said, is, you know, little seedlings, if they're in a sunny window, they probably do need to be watered once a day, but make sure that the very surface is drying out to the touch a little bit before you water. And the other thing that we didn't talk about was, once those seeds germinate and you remove that plastic, then you want to get them in the brightest light possible. Okay, so like I said, my mom put them on her south window, And she got tomato plants and they were fine. Okay. But really, they didn't have as much sunlight as they would have preferred. So this is where it depends on your situation. If you have a sunny window, you can utilize that. If you don't have enough of a sunny window, then we're talking about supplemental lighting. And even if you have a sunny window, supplemental lighting is important. So you want to put them in a bright place. You want that nice bright light. If you're putting a grow light, supplemental lighting over the top, and there's so many great LED versions out there now, you want that light to be just 3 to 4 inches above the foliage of your plants. So you want to put them on, you know, chains or something where you can raise them or lower them as the plants grow. And you would set that timer for about 16 hours a day. So it goes on before you get up or off after you go to bed. And that's really important because, again, that's the plants then doing photosynthesis, and that's how they form their food, and that's what they use to grow. The other thing to think about is the temperature in the room that you put them in. So contrary to popular belief, we think, oh, they want it nice and warm because we see them, you know, we go to the greenhouse to buy them, but that's not actually true. So a lot of people have trouble with getting leggy plants or spindly or, you know, kind of floppy and stuff. And if you're getting that, that means you have not enough light, but too much warmth. So low light, high temperature equals spindly, leggy plants. So ideally, you're going to put these seedlings in a place where they have bright light for 16 to 18 hours a day, and the temperature is only like 68 degrees. And that's almost challenging to do at this point in the year, because I don't know about you, but I've got west-facing windows and my living room warms up into the 70s at this time of year. And that's actually too warm for growing them. And so we think, okay, yeah, but they grow in these hot greenhouses, but the greenhouse growers have fans and vents that open up and go on as soon as the temperature is getting up into the 70s. So bright light. And if you're not sure how much light you're getting, there are phone apps that you can get that read the lumens, and you can put them where your plants are and see exactly how many lumens of light your light is producing for your plants. And you can monitor it that way. But cooler temperatures, bright light, water after the surface gets dry. And you really don't need to fertilize until you're into probably 4 weeks. We usually say once the seedlings get their first set of true leaves, and then you can use a little bit of a liquid fertilizer at like half the strength that it says on the package. One of the things is that nowadays the seed starting and the potting mixes all have fertilizer in them. And, you know, that's a little unfortunate because they may or may not have the right amount of fertilizer that we want for seedlings. But if that's all you've got, a lot of those say that it lasts for 8 weeks. Well, then you never have to fertilize your seedlings. But you don't want to over-fertilize those tender little roots. So any fertilizer you put on at a low rate.
Okay. And when you talk about the light, obviously the ideal situation would be if you could move the lights up and down as the seedlings grow, right? You don't want it too close or too far away.
Right. And so I have a unique situation. And this is what I get at, where everybody has to do what works for them, right? I have a lot of cats in my house, so I can't just let these little seedling trees be out there because they would be so much entertainment for the cats. So last year, I had an old wire dog crate, and I set that on a table by my west windows, and I have a grow light in there that's on a chain. And I can open the door on the dog crate and take care of my seedlings, but the cats can't get to it. And it's genius. It just is so wonderful. But my chains on my lights aren't long enough when the seedlings are little to be 4 inches above. So I put books underneath my plants to raise the plants up to the light level. And then as they grew, I would take a book a week out kind of a thing and get things back down. So whatever works for you. And that's what I mean is there's no one way, and you don't have to, you know, buy anything fancy and invest in a whole professional setup. You can make do with what you have.
Sure, absolutely. We are talking about starting seeds, but we can also take your other gardening calls. If you want to, if you have a question for Diana, give us a call at 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send an email. It's talk@wpr.org. And speaking of emails, Lisa in Madison emailed to say that British gardening shows always emphasize how important it is to use peat-free soil and compost. And she's wondering, is peat something that we should be trying to avoid in the U.S.? We talked a little bit about this earlier, but it's definitely a big question these days.
Yeah. So the reason that they say to avoid peat is because peat is not a renewable resource. And they dig peat out of peat bogs. And these are, you know, peat is basically dead plants that died and hit the ground, and it's in places where the temperature is cool and the moisture is high, and so those plants don't decompose as fast as like the leaves in my backwoods do every year, and so that peat grows up. But they dig it out of there, they mine it out of there, and there are questions about the environmental impact of that and, you know, pulling all of that out. So that's why they say avoid peat. It has nothing to do with its effectiveness and growing good seedlings. And so if you want to avoid that, that's great. There are other alternatives. There are some mixes that are using the coconut
coir.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But there have been some research studies that have shown that seedlings don't establish as well using that. So even though the texture and, you know, it kind of looks the same, it's not really recommended. You can use a normal normal potting mix. A lot of potting mixes don't have peat in them. They're compost. Okay. A lot of it is composted wood chips and whatever. You can use your own compost that you've used. The only thing is that peat, because the pH is very low, that's why it's sterile and why it, or mostly sterile, and why you have less problems with the damping off that I mentioned earlier if you use a peat seed starting mix. Now, honestly, you know, the question also comes in and how many seedlings are you going to start? Okay. For most of us, our home gardens, my bag of seed starting mix lasted 3 years. Okay. So I'm not using a lot of it. I know there are some people that start hundreds of seeds, and especially if you get into doing flowers and stuff. So then, you know, you're using more of a volume, but that's just one of those questions that, you know, you ask for yourself. What you don't want to use is garden soil, because garden soil comes with all kinds of disease and insect organisms in it. And when I was a kid, okay, going back, and I'm retired now, so you know how long ago we're talking, all right?
Do the math.
But my mom, you know, and that's the thing is, you know, people have been starting seeds inside for, you know, ever, and being successful at it. So if you're a beginner, I don't want you to be, you know, intimidated by this process. It's not that hard. as long as you provide what the seeds need, like we talked about. But my mom used to take garden soil and she would bake it in the oven with the idea of killing those disease organisms and stuff. And I will tell you first that the thing I remember mostly is it stinks like crazy. It stinks up the whole house. But the research has shown that that's not really that great of an idea, because while, yes, it might kill some disease organisms, it also kills beneficial microorganisms that are in the soil. So you end up with, you know, so that's not really that great either. And garden soil is sand, silt, and clay, and it compacts. It doesn't have the aeration that potting mixes and seed starting mixes have that, you know, give a good growing habitat for those tiny little baby roots and stuff. So garden soil is not recommended. You can use compost. You can use a peat-free potting mix. It's, again, these seedlings are only in there for 8 weeks. They go out into the garden. So they're adaptable.
Sure. Yeah, I think sometimes we baby things a little too much, right? We had Pat send an email seeking advice about starting seeds in little cold frames outside. They've seen people use milk jugs and wonder how successful this would be. Have you had any experience with that?
Sure. So there's, when you see the milk jug thing, mostly that's associated with something called winter sowing. And what that is, that you can cut the milk jug top off, put potting mix in the bottom, put your seeds in there, and you can set them outside in the middle of winter. And the idea is that once the days are getting longer and it's time, the seeds will germinate in there, and they're in their little protected, you know, covered with the milk jug thing. And then you can plant them out to your flower beds or garden, whatever, later. The thing to remember with that, though, is that that only works for plants that can handle cold temperatures. You can't do this with tomatoes or marigolds or anything that's frost sensitive, because at night, you know, next week we're going to get the 20s and at least up here. And so they'll freeze at night. So that's more useful for things like purple coneflowers or you know, native flowers, that sort of thing. You could do probably, you know, things like broccoli and cauliflower that are cool season plants. The cold frames thing is sort of the same thing. It does warm up in there earlier in the spring, so the soil in there and stuff warms up faster than is out in the open. But you have a cloudy day with no sun and the temperature gets cold at night, anything in there is likely to get frost damage. So it's an option, but it's not going to work for warm season tomatoes, peppers, marigolds.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of the seeds or the varieties of plants, some seeds do not have to be started inside, right? They probably do just as well if you start them in the garden. So what are some seeds that you suggest that we use inside?
Right. That's a really good question. So our growing season is supposedly not long enough for some things, and that's why we start them indoors so that we get a head start on it. But a lot of them, we have to remember that one thing we didn't talk about was hardening off. Okay. So once it gets time to where it's getting close to being planted outside, gardeners are always so impatient, right?
Yes.
But you have to remember that tomatoes are, you know, they're from what, South America or whatever. They like heat. And so if you put them outside into your garden too soon, they're just going to sit there and shiver and they don't grow. And no matter what, there's going to be transplant shock. So we have to harden them off some first. And up here in our area, you know, it's maybe a little earlier in the southern part of the state, but we shoot for Memorial Day, okay? Because until Memorial Day, the soil temperature is not warm enough and the nighttime temperatures are not warm enough. So a couple weeks before that, you need to start taking your little seedling babies out for an outing every day. And the hardening off process is at least 2 weeks. And the first day you put them outside and they're just in the shade. That shade is actually pretty bright light compared to inside your house. So you put them outside in the shade the first day. If the temperature at night is going to get below 55, you bring them in because they really want night temperatures to be 60s. So then the next day you take them out and they get morning sun, like from 9 to 10, no more than an hour. And every day you increase that amount of sunlight that they get by 15 to 30 minutes. If you give them too much sunlight all at once, the leaves will brown and singe and fry and crisp up. And that's not a good thing. So do this process slowly, 2 weeks minimum. 3 weeks is even better. And once they're used to being outside in that full sun, then you can plant them in the garden, assuming your soil temperature and nighttime temperatures are going to be warm enough. And you can get soil thermometers. You can use a kitchen thermometer, stick it 4 inches down in the soil, see what the soil temperature is. Because even though our air temperature might be warm, your soil temperature takes longer to get up there. And the soil type that you have makes a difference too. So clay warms up slower than sand does in the spring. If you have a raised bed, that warms up faster than a flat ground goes. So there's a lot of variability there. But if you put your warm season plants like tomatoes and peppers and marigolds out in cold soil, they don't grow. And they just sit there and they get set back. So back to your original question of what do we just plant directly out? And a lot of the bigger seeds and the things that need warmth or things that don't like to be transplanted because their roots get disturbed. So normally we plant directly out things like peas, spinach, squashes, cucumbers, potatoes, lettuce, you can go either way. If it's a leaf lettuce, just plant outside. It grows so fast and you can put that in cooler soil. But if you're trying to grow like a head lettuce, a lot of people will start those inside like 3 to 4 weeks early and then transplant them out. We never used to see things like squash and melons and cucumbers in the greenhouses because everybody just planted those outside. But now there's more of that. But there's a real question on if that transplant shock sets them back so much that you may as well have just seeded the plants. And I'm going to tell you a tiny little story because once late June and July come about and our days are warm and long and the temperature's warm, these plants really catch up. Okay. So when I was a kid, mom and dad were having an argument about planting tomatoes or whatever. Anyway, it resulted in my mom starting her seeds inside like normal 8 weeks in advance. And also right next to those plants, direct sowing tomato seeds in the garden. And the ones that she started indoors 8 weeks early only produced tomatoes 1 week earlier in the garden. And, you know, we've all kind of had that where you have a volunteer tomato plant that grew up in your garden and you get tomatoes by the end of the season, right? And again, those long, warm days, the plants do a lot of development and growth. And so they catch up a lot. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the same thing with, you know, like if you're doing winter squash and you're, you know, just wanting to harvest them in fall to store, our season is plenty long enough. And whatever you're growing, make sure that you look at the packet and see what the harvest length is. So there are some tomatoes that are from the time they're transplanted, that's 65 days. And there are others that are 80 days. So make those choices accordingly. We are in Wisconsin, not Missouri, so we do have to, you know, think about that growing season length.
Sure.
But there are plenty of options available to just direct seed them in the garden.
All right, great. Thank you, Diana. We are talking with Diana Alfus. She's from the up north. She's recently retired as the UW Extension Horticulture Outreach Specialist for Pierce County. If you have a question for her, 800-642-1234 is our number, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Hope you can join us again on Monday. We're going to be talking to the author of a great new book on lumberjacks. And then at noon, we'll hear from the weather guys. That's Monday starting at 11 right here on WPR. Right now, we're talking gardening and we've got a bunch of calls all of a sudden, Diana. So let's just go right to Steve in the Appleton area. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I got a question about the 4-week maybe transplanting and putting them in bigger pots. Could I use worm castings for the fertilizer?
Sure you can. And that, you know, that's another, that brings up a whole nother issue about transplanting into bigger pots. So some people plant their seeds in small containers, and then after they get their first set of true leaves, they pot them up into bigger containers so that they have more room for those roots to grow, so that by the time they go out to the garden, they have a bigger root ball. And that is totally up to you. Personally, I can't be bothered with that extra step because I never seem to have time for that. But it does give you the opportunity for bigger, healthier transplants. Worm castings are great. They have a lot of nutrients and stuff in them. Is it enough fertilizer? That'll depend on the size of your container that you're putting them into and the analysis of those worm castings, which so often they don't even say it on there. But the way to tell is just, you know, if the plants are doing well and they're putting on growth and they're nice green color and stuff, you've got enough fertilizer in there. And it's actually better to under fertilize a tiny bit than to over fertilize. So if things seem a little off color after you do that, then you might just give them a little bit of a liquid fertilizer in addition to the worm castings. But worm castings have a lot of nutrients and they add some good organic matter to soils.
Okay, thanks for the call, Steve. Next up from Sturgeon Bay, we have Stella. Go right ahead.
Hi, I was just calling. We live in Sturgeon Bay. We're surrounded by Lake Michigan and Green Bay and the Bay of Sturgeon Bay, so everything's covered in ice during the winter. We have very late springs, and we have late falls. It stays cold in the spring for a longer time than usual other places and stays warm in the fall longer. And as a result, my husband starts plants like squash and cucumbers and gourds and sweet corn that do not like to have their roots disturbed. He starts them in our greenhouse in newspaper pots. He makes these pots out of newspaper, wraps them around, he uses about a four inch diameter round thing, and wraps the newspaper around it and then flattens the bottom. And I don't know, do you wet it to, it wets it to make it, hold its shape, and then plants in those pots. And then when it comes time to plant the plants outside, you just dig a hole and put the whole works, the whole thing in the hole. And the roots grow right through the newspaper, and the newspaper decomposes, and the roots aren't disturbed at all, and it works beautifully.
Yeah, I've used that myself. Diana, what do you think?
Yep, making newspaper pots is common, and that kind of gets back to, it's a great example of, you can do it in a gazillion different ways. Some people use Dixie cups, lightweight paper cups, and do the same thing. There are also soil block makers that you can get that basically compress the soil into a square and there's no container holding it together, but just the compaction holds it together. The one thing is, newspaper is considered organic. It will rot away, and as you say, those roots will grow right through it. As long as you don't put too many layers of newspaper on there. So if you make that newspaper pot too thick with too many layers on it, it will provide a little bit of a barrier and make it take longer for those roots to be able to grow outward through it. And if that's the case, when you go to planting, you can just kind of like peel off some of the outer layers to make it less. But if the roots are already growing into that paper by the time you're planting them, then you don't want to do that because that would rip off little roots and stuff. But yep, the newspaper pots is a great thing. I know people who have used toilet paper rolls. Okay, so you just set them upright and you fill them with potting mix and you plant them. And that cardboard, especially if it's a lighter weight one, that will be kind of the same as the newspaper. So lots of different methods to go about that are not expensive.
And those egg cartons, too, I've seen people, not the styrofoam ones, but the ones that are the paper ones, just take those, cut them up and put those in, too. I don't know how long it takes to dissolve in the soil, but yeah, lots of different options. Right. So
and remember that these seedling roots are tender and little and stuff. So you don't want any kind of a barrier to keep them from growing outward. And remember that roots grow outward, not as much downward as they grow outward. So if there's anything that's kind of stiff there or not going to decompose within, you know, a week or so, you would want to remove some of that. But lots of different options.
Well, let's go to one more call. We've got George in Egg Harbor. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call. I'm just curious. I am... by no means do I have a green thumb. I've ordered some rhizomes. I'm going to be planting hops. I have friends that brew beer, and I love the way hop vines look. But, you know, up here in Egg Harbor, you know, it stays cold for a pretty long time. The company that I ordered from is supposedly going to send the rhizomes when the soil is close to ready. But... How do you recommend, what's the best way to plant them? I do know that they need well-drained soil and, you know, possibly some regular manure for fertilizer, but that's about my extent of knowledge of planting.
Okay, thanks, George. Warn him. Warn him, Diana.
So hops are an interesting plant, and I also think they're beautiful and really like to grow. My hops that are growing are nowhere near where I originally planted them. The original ones have died out, but I have them on my garden fence line now. So they do move, they do seed, and they get very large, and depending on the variety, and there are different varieties. So the ones I planted were ornamental, and the ones that are planted for beer with the flavors and stuff, you know, they come in different sizes and stuff too. But you're right, they do like well-drained soil, and they like organic matter. So they're not going to do well in like a heavy compacted clay soil, and they're also not as happy on a sand, that sort of a thing. So like you said, working in composted manure, something like that into the soil, and then planting the rhizomes in there, they, like I say, can almost be a little weedy. And so they're, once they, you know, get established, they're pretty tough. As far
very
as when
tough.
They, yeah, when they come, they don't, you know, they don't like freezing temperatures. So if they come, the rhizomes come, if it isn't warm enough where you are yet, you can usually hold them in the refrigerator, just, you know, keep them in the refrigerator if they're still in rhizomes. If they've got leaves on them already, then they need to be doing photosynthesis. You can't put them in the dark. Okay. So in that case, you might, you know, depending on when they ship them, because these places don't always know what our temperature really is here when they ship them. But you can like heal them in some pots or somewhere just in some loose potting soil so that they can be getting the sun. They might grow a little bit and then you'll be transplanting them out, but they're not hard to grow. And as I said, they can form quite a jungle. So just be prepared for that. Make sure that you have good trellising support system, because they'll pull things down. They get a lot of weight on them when they are a mature vine.
Yes, they're, and like you said, they're beautiful, and they're really difficult to get rid of. and if you plant them somewhere where you don't want them to take over, you might regret that. Not that I'm saying I have experience or anything, but...
Yeah, me neither. They are neat in winter see those
They are
dried flower.
Yeah, they're really pretty. So we've got about a couple minutes here left. Dana emailed to ask if you use a countertop aerial garden, like a hydroponic one, to start seedlings like peppers and tomatoes and then transfer to the soil planters outside. Will that work?
Sure. And again, as long as you're providing all the stuff that we talked about that the seeds need and the light, you can definitely do the countertop thing. As I said, there's lots of different ways that you can do it. You just want to make sure that you still harden those plants off before you put them right out in the garden, because those lights are nowhere near as bright as sunshine.
Absolutely. Diana, thank you so much for being with us today. We really appreciate that. And I want to thank you for joining us, and also for all the people on our team, Clara Neipert, Joel Patenaud, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins, and of course, Larry Mueller. Have a wonderful weekend.